Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. This week I have a must list, you know I love those, and a really interesting list, and that's all I'll tell you for now. So let's start with that must list, two long-awaited returns, Outlander prequel, Blood of My Blood, and Chapel Roan's new single topped this week's must list. From the King of the Hill revival to Freakier Friday and Weapons, read our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. It may be Friday, but we're all about Wednesday over here at EW. Check out our latest cover story that dives into that deadly cliffhanger, but only after watching those first four episodes. In other news, I thought I'd be writing this letter on my way to see Kelly Clarkson in Las Vegas, but for devastating reasons, she's canceled her residency shows for the month. In this profession, you get a little numb to the sadder events we cover, but as a big Kelly fan, this one has stayed with me. My heart goes out to her and her family, as I'm sure all of yours do as well. That's Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. King of the Hill tops our list. When Hank, played by Mike Judge, and Peggy Hill, played by Kathy Najimy, moved back to the U.S. after living in Saudi Arabia, they returned to a Texas featuring all-gender bathrooms, electric vehicles, and boba tea shops. Hulu's fantastic 14th season lets Hank confront America's new normal without sacrificing his dedication to civility, truth, and propane. Whether taking on fraught issues, cultural appropriation, misinformation, or reuniting 21-year-old Bobby Hill, played by Pamela Adlon, with his childhood crush Connie, played by Lauren Tom, King of the Hill delivers laughs with its signature blend of insight, sly humor, and silliness. Freakier Friday is next. Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis are back in top form, but not in each other's bodies this time around. In the bewitching sequel to Freaky Friday, it's a foursome of supernatural body swapping, yet the star's charismatic connection remains the same. Outlander, Blood of My Blood. Jamie and Claire's parents get a prequel that's quickly become our new favorite guilty pleasure. Forbidden love, Highland clan warfare, and yes, time travel all take center stage in this Stars series that somehow improves on the original. Chapel Roan's The Subway. Chapel Roan's long-delayed studio version of this live favorite has finally arrived, complete with a wiggy New York City set video. Can the song of the summer be a bit of a bummer? If it's as undeniably gorgeous as this slice of dream pop, absolutely. Weapons. We can't talk about the best parts of Barbarian director Zach Krieger's new horror movie without revealing spoilers. But we'll tease that the surface-level premise of 17 missing kids from the same elementary school class hides a much more thrilling, twisty, messed-up iceberg. That is our must list. It was by the Entertainment Weekly staff, two long-awaited returns, Outlander prequel, Blood of My Blood, and Chapel Roan's new single, topping the list. We have a review of Freakier Friday. Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan deliver the sequel millennials deserve. The body swap comedy gets raised to the fourth power with hilarious and touching results. This is by Maureen Lee Lanker. For a generation of millennials and their moms, Freaky Friday was it, the ultimate. The beloved body swap comedy, which has been remade several times since 1976's rendition starring Jodie Foster, tapped into the zeitgeist with its 2003 iteration starring Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis. Ask any woman in their 30s how many times they jammed out to Pink Slip in their mom's minivan or rewatched a clip of Chad Michael Murray singing Britney Spears in a suburban front yard. With that verdant fan base, it was probably inevitable that Disney would get the gang back together again for a sequel, which has finally materialized with Freakier Friday, some 20-plus years later. Just as the first film surprised and charmed with its heart, zippy sense of humor, and standout lead performances, Freakier Friday recaptures and strengthens the magic. With Nisha Ganatra from Late Night taking over for Mark Waters from Mean Girls in the director's chair, the sequel finds ways to freshen up the antics of the first film while providing plenty of callbacks for the original fans. 22 years after the events of the first film, Anna, played by Loewen, is a single mom struggling to balance her job as a music manager and parenting her teenage daughter Harper, played by Julia Butters. She gets plenty of backup from her mom, Tess, played by Curtis, who has channeled her success as a therapist into a podcast, a book, and a mostly well-adjusted 30-something daughter. But when Harper gets into a fight with the new kid at school, Lily, played by Sophia Hammonds, it brings Anna into the path of a single dad, Eric, played by Manny Jacinto. And one very adorable montage later, the two are setting a wedding date. This is where the body swapping comes back in, with bickering at Anna's bachelorette party that apparently her mother, daughter, and future stepdaughter are all invited to, leading to a quadruple swap. Anna trades bodies with Harper, and Tess switches with Lily. Ganatra and screenwriter Jordan Weiss find old truths and fresh takes within the simple setup that gets dizzyingly complicated quickly. The age gap jokes may hit similar notes as the first film, but they're still hilarious in their brutal honesty. Taking a loving swipe at everything from Facebook's aging demographic to pickleball to an older white woman's predilection for puffer jackets and pockets filled with tissues. Lily, stuck in Tess's body, bemoans the crevices in her face, her cracking knees, and the challenges of getting up off the floor past the age of 50. Such moments not only echo Curtis's "I'm old!" screech in the original film, but elevate it to a farcical, if still utterly real, level. Anna is older now, too, adopting her mom's "make good choices" school drop-off mantra, and struggling to figure out some of the intricacies of her phone's latest iOS. She now not only understands what her mom went through, but she's living it. Harper and Lily are Gen Z teenagers miles away from the rebellious rocker vibes of Loewen's teenage Anna. Harper is a tomboy surfer, while Lily is an aspiring fashion designer. The shifting values and vibes of different generations provide plenty of delicious fodder for Loewen and Curtis when they're meant to be playing the young girls trapped in their bodies. I think my body might have levitated after hearing Loewen use the word bet in a sentence, the entire sentence being bet. Butters and Hammonds are warm and winning as older women trapped in their young bodies. They get plenty of wisecracks about having good bone density and a goofy, frolicsome montage where they enjoy eating junk food their older bodies can no longer withstand. However, the main event is seeing Loewen and Curtis reunited, and even better, together. Tess and Anna were often apart in the first film, fish out of water in opposing scenarios, but here, with Lily and Harper in their bodies, they team up, trying to upend the wedding of their dad and mom. Curtis, who worked for years to get a sequel greenlit, is clearly having the time of her life, mugging for the camera as inner fashionista Lily, supporting a speech-inhibiting lip plumper, and taking a joyride in a Camaro. But it's Loewen who's the film's heart and soul. For the first time since her return to acting in 2022's Falling for Christmas, Loan looks like she's having fun. The ease, maturity, and comedic timing of her child star years are at last back in full force. It's particularly on display in a gleeful sequence in which she, as Harper, attempts to flirt with Anna's old flame, Jake, played by Murray, wildly flipping her hair, biting her lips, and winking as if Lucille Bluth taught her how to bat her eyes. It's comforting to see the Loan spark restored, her joy in her work spilling off the screen with infectious zeal. The guys get their own chance to shine, with Murray reprising the role of Jake, the motorcycle-riding bad boy who once stole Anna's heart and, in turn, developed a crush on Tess. He infuses Jake with the same oblivious charm and golden retriever energy that made him so winning two decades ago. Mark Harmon also returns as Ryan, Tess's husband, ever steadfast and supportive of her whirling dervish personality. It's lovely to see them back as these characters, but it's newcomer Manny Jacinto who gets the true spotlight. After breaking out on The Good Place and seducing us to the dark side as a smoldering Sith daddy, hashtag save the acolyte, Jacinto is at long last getting his due as a romantic leading man. Adopting a British accent as widower Eric, he's dreamy in his devotion to Anna and his daughter Lily, the epitome of decency and paternal fortitude. He steals hearts and the scene with a dance sequence that embraces his hip-hop background, making us wish he were in more of the film. But at the end of the day, Freakier Friday is a movie about mothers and daughters, and now sisters, Lee, Loan, Hammonds, and Butters are all performing sleight of hand in their deceptively difficult task of portraying their characters and other characters stuck in their bodies. Lee and Loan in particular bring not only comedic aplomb to this challenge, but genuine pathos and emotion too, as they realize bigger truths about their parents through walking in their shoes. Part of the joy of the viewing experience is unquestionably the callbacks to Hit Me Baby One More Time and the Pink Slip performance that we'll be feeling the high of for weeks to come. Shout out also to songwriter Sarah Ahrens for penning Baby, a new soundtrack banger essential to the plot. There's even a The Parent Trap connection for all the Loan fans. But what makes Freakier Friday so special is that amid the laugh-out-loud humor and welcome fan service, there's also a beautiful film here about parenting, coming of age, loneliness, grief, loss, and sacrifice. To be human is to experience the highs and lows of all that life has to offer, and to be a parent is to do so tenfold, with your heart beating outside of your own body. Freakier Friday celebrates that and literalizes it, acknowledging the challenges acute to any age, as well as the foibles and perks of life's different lessons. If the original film is about a mother and daughter coming to better understand each other, Freakier Friday throws its arms open to wrap them around the notion of family as a whole. The ways in which we show up for each other make being together and being at home one and the same, and how to know that we're exactly where we belong. It's a heart-on-its-sleeve ode to strengthening and forging bonds, the power of deep and unconditional love, and the warmth and safety of one's chosen family, most especially when it's at its freakiest. That's the review of Freakier Friday. Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan deliver the sequel Millennials Deserve. It was by Maureen Lee Lanker, who's giving the movie a grade of A-. We also have from the movie section a review. There's no grade associated with it. The question for us is Ice Cube's War of the Worlds on Amazon really as bad as everyone is saying? An alien invasion looks pretty good about now. This is by Jordan Hoffman. With the barrage of content streaming at us with the ferocity of weaponized meteors, one can be forgiven for missing the memo about every new movie. Something that could easily fall through the cracks is a new version of H.G. Wells' classic tale of sci-fi terror, War of the Worlds, premiering on Amazon Prime, starring Ice Cube, and directed by music video veteran Rich Lee, making his feature film debut. However, when the first reviews for this project came back, every single one of them was negative, resulting in a 0% on Rotten Tomatoes. This rare feat led to public ridicule, prompting Cube's son, O'Shea Jackson Jr., to chime in on X and somewhat defend the project. He simply pointed out that it was shot during the pandemic and it had been sitting on the shelf for 5 years. So before anything else, is this movie really that bad? The answer is absolutely not. It's certainly stupid, but it's also a great deal of fun. War of the Worlds 2025 is never boring. It is filled with entertaining lines, and it has a cheese factor that is perfectly self-aware. To wit, Ice Cube shouting, "Move, bitch! Get out of the way!" at an alien tendril blocking his path certainly has a spring in its step. The problem is that Rotten Tomatoes requires a binary yay or nay vote, and only about 20 critics weighed in by the time the headlines emerged about it being an all-time turkey. But the old saying goes that there's no such thing as bad publicity, and this is an excellent case study. People are now on alert and hopefully ordering out for pizza, cracking open a sixer, and getting ready to chomp into this new dumbass classic. No one who watches this in that context will be anything less than delighted. The War of the Worlds was first published in 1898, shortly after Wells's The Time Machine, The Island of Dr. Moreau, and The Invisible Man. It was the source material for Orson Welles' groundbreaking radio drama, an early experiment in mock documentary theater that scared the pants off of listeners who did not clock that it was fiction and thought invaders from Mars were storming New Jersey. I guess you can't get a pork roll, egg, and cheese in space. Other notable iterations of the story followed: a classic 1950s B-movie produced by George Pal, an epic progressive rock concept album from British composer Jeff Wayne, and Steven Spielberg's truly terrifying 2005 Tom Cruise-led film, which most people interpret as the great filmmaker's artistic reaction to the events of 9/11. The point is, we shouldn't be too precious about new ways to tell this tale, so a so-called screen life style rendering is not, on the face of it, a bad idea. This style of project is one in which almost everything you see is the reflection of one person's computer monitor. Video chats and YouTube clips add to the dynamism, but a lot of the time, you are just watching what some guy is typing. Gee, whatever happened to escapism? If I wanted to look at chat windows and listen to DM pings, I could stay at work. But Ice Cube's character, William Radford, in War of the Worlds, has no ordinary job. He's a top-level Department of Homeland Security analyst, and when he's at his post, he's got eyes and ears on everything. Naturally, he uses this for personal reasons, spying on his son David, played by Henry Hunter Hall, daughter Faith, played by Iman Benson, and her dopey Amazon delivery driver boyfriend Mark, played by Devin Bostick, exuding Diet Pete Davidson vibes. For exposition purposes, he also regularly visits the Facebook page of his late wife so we can hear her final messages and look at old photos. Well, about 15 minutes in, and after Radford's NASA chum, played by Eva Longoria, alerts him to the radical weather disasters that have been causing mayhem across the globe, as if he would not be aware, destruction rains down from the heavens, sending the world's security teams into overdrive. Radford springs into action, but from the comfort of his ergonomic chair. Action heroes today. Tabs and windows fly all over the screen as Radford zooms and WhatsApps with government colleagues and his panicked children. It's a smart way to cut down on the special effects budget, since the only glimpses of the malevolent creatures are on wobbly cell phones or glitchy videos. After several sequences of destruction and the President of the United States formally initiating a War of the Worlds, it comes down to Radford and his kids saving the day. Well, not just them, also some of our most questionable corporations. When an injured Faith has to get across town, Radford hacks into the self-driving functions of a Tesla to escort her to safety. When the world-saving biocomputer virus must be inserted into a thingamajig and needs to get somewhere, Mike deploys Prime Air, the future of delivery, meaning an Amazon-branded drone. He also bribes a passerby to help using a $1,000 Amazon gift card. Even though all the power grids have been turned to ash, good luck ordering your paper towels, friend. The fact that this movie is streaming on Amazon and Amazon is presented as the only thing that could ever save humanity from an existential threat is hilarious. It goes full ludicrous when Ice Cube confronts a rogue surveillance baddie played by Clark Gregg and shouts, "You risked all of our lives just to spy on people's Amazon carts?" Cube's performance in War of the Worlds is a masterclass in mugging and finding new ways to mutter, "Hell nah." Though there is a visual fluidity to the project, it feels as if someone got scared audiences would not be able to follow the story, so they slapped a coat of voiceover narration atop the entire thing. As such, there is a lot of Ice Cube talking to himself, and lines vary from simple, "Wait, what?" when we see a top-secret message, to an electrifying, "Take your intergalactic asses back home!" when the tables appear to be turned. This movie is a mess, but it's an uproarious one. Should intelligent beings from a distant star ever come here and get a look at something like this, they would never, ever kill us, so long as they had a sense of humor. That was Is Ice Cube's War of the Worlds on Amazon Really as Bad as Everyone is Saying? And it was by Jordan Hoffman. Again, there's no rating or grade to this one. The next Barbenheimer, this is also from the movie section. Kristen Wiig and Jonah Hill set out to take down Christopher Nolan with new comedy. Hill will co-write and direct Cut Off, which will release on the same day as The Odyssey in 2026. This is by Wesley Stenzel. Can Kristen Wiig and Jonah Hill take down the Cyclops? The Bridesmaids star and the 21 Jump Street actor are set to star in a new comedy film, Cut Off, Entertainment Weekly has learned. Hill, who previously helmed the indie coming-of-age dramedy Mid-90s, is directing and co-writing, while Ezra Woods is also helping pen the project. Deadline reported that the movie will follow two wealthy siblings who are financially cut off from their parents. The movie will begin production in the fall so that Warner Brothers can release it on July 17, 2026, which is the same day that Christopher Nolan's period epic The Odyssey will sail into theaters. This marks the second time in a row that Warner Brothers has scheduled a high-profile comedy against a Nolan film, and also the second time that Nolan has made a movie for rival studio Universal, following his 9-movie streak with Warner Brothers. The first? Barbie, which memorably opened on the same day as Nolan's Oppenheimer in July 2023. However, Barbie and Oppenheimer were both high-budget projects that the respective studios considered tentpole blockbusters. Barbie reportedly cost $145 million, while Oppenheimer cost around $100 million. The Odyssey, on the other hand, may have cost as much as those two films combined, with a $250 million price tag, according to The Hollywood Reporter. Cut Off, on the other hand, will reportedly cost $49 million, making it one of Warner Brothers' less expensive ventures in 2026. The studio is also set to release Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow, Maggie Gyllenhaal's Frankenstein riff, The Bride, and possibly a third Dune movie, which will all bear significantly higher budgets than Cut Off. With all that in mind, it's likely that Cut Off is an attempt at counter-programming rather than a genuine challenge to The Odyssey's inevitable box office domination. Wig has not appeared in a theatrical live-action movie since 2019's Where'd You Go, Bernadette. However, she's set to play a villainous role in Gabby's Dollhouse, the movie, which releases in September and has kept busy as the lead of Apple TV Plus's series Palm Royale. Hill will next appear in Outcome, a comedy he co-wrote, co-produced, and directed for Apple. The film also stars Keanu Reeves, Cameron Diaz, Matt Bomer, David Spade, and Laverne Cox. Wig and Hill previously appeared in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Knocked Up, and Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story together, though they played supporting roles in all three projects. They also both lent their voices to the original How to Train Your Dragon animated trilogy, as well as Sausage Party. That was the next Barbenheimer. Kristen Wiig and Jonah Hill set out to take down Christopher Nolan with new comedy. It was by Wesley Stenzel. I'm going to take a quick moment here to remind everybody that you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I am reading from their website, which is EW.com. Here's something about Tom Hanks paying tribute to John Lovell, the famed astronaut he portrayed in Apollo 13. Godspeed to you on this next voyage. Lovell, commander of the near-fatal Apollo 13 mission, died Thursday at the age of 97. This is by Jessica Wang. Tom Hanks paid homage to the famed astronaut Jim Lovell, whom he portrayed in the Academy Award-winning 1995 feature Apollo 13 in the wake of his death. There are people who dare, who dream, and who lead others to the places we would not go on our own, Hanks wrote on Instagram. Jim Lovell, who for a long while had gone farther into space for longer than any person on our planet, was that kind of guy. His voyages were not made for riches or celebrity, Hanks said, but because such challenges as those are what fuels the course of being alive, and who better than Jim Lovell to make those voyages, Hanks added. On this night of a full moon, he passes on to the heavens, to the cosmos, to the stars. Godspeed you on this next voyage, Hanks concluded. Lovell, best known as the commander of the near-fatal Apollo 13 mission to the moon that served as the basis of Apollo 13, died Thursday in Illinois at the age of 97. We are saddened to announce the passing of our beloved father, USN Captain James A. Jim Lovell, a Navy pilot and officer, astronaut, leader, and space explorer, Lovell's family said in a statement. We are enormously proud of his amazing life and career accomplishments, highlighted by his legendary leadership in pioneering human spaceflight. The statement continued, but to all of us, he was dad, granddad, and the leader of our family. Most importantly, he was our hero. We will miss his unshakable optimism, sense of humor, and the way he made each of us feel we could do the impossible. He was truly one of a kind. Lovell, who joined NASA in 1962, was a veteran of spacecrafts Gemini 7, Gemini 12, and Apollo 8 missions before he became commander of the infamous Apollo 13 mission to the moon. An oxygen tank exploded during the April 1970 expedition, significantly damaging the spacecraft and forcing the three-person crew to use the lunar module as a lifeboat. They manage to return to Earth after a harrowing 6 days stranded in space. He retired in 1973. The near-fatal incident received the Hollywood treatment with Ron Howard's Apollo 13. Hank's phrase, "Houston, we have a problem," is a version of Lovell's own dispatch to NASA ground control following the explosion, which became part of the cinematic lexicon. Lovell's actual radio transmission was, "Houston, we've had a problem." Bill Paxton, Ed Harris, Kevin Bacon, and Gary Sinise also starred in the film, which features a brief cameo from Lovell himself. Ron Howard puts a lot of his own people, especially his family, in his movies, Lovell recounted to the Illinois newspaper Lake County News Sun in 2019. So as the movie was going on, he said, "Would you like to be in the movie? I'll make you the admiral of the ship that recovers you." I said, "No, I retired as a captain. I'll dig out my uniform of a captain, my own uniform. I'll dust it off. It was my uniform. I took it out and put it on to make sure it didn't have any spots on it." Lovell told Conan O'Brien during a late-night interview in the 90s that he became acquainted with Hanks during production, even inviting the star out to his home in Texas and letting him fly his airplane at night to get a sense of what it was like to navigate a spacecraft. "You let Forrest Gump take the controls of the plane?" an incredulous O'Brien asked. Yeah, I was worried about that," quipped Lovell. "But my niece went to see the movie and she said, well, I knew they'd make it okay because Forrest Gump was flying." That was Tom Hanks pays tribute to Jim Lovell, the famed astronaut he portrayed in Apollo 13. Godspeed you on this next voyage. That was by Jessica Wang. And here's what I hinted to at the top of the show. A fun list, it's our 30 favorite pop culture partners in crime, from Walt and Jesse to Thelma and Louise. These are the duos we love watching get away with it. This is by Kevin Jacobson. There's something undeniably compelling about criminal behavior on the big or small screen. Watching someone choose a dangerous alternative path to find success, freedom, or a combination of both. Add in a partner in crime, and you've captured our full attention. Cinema and television have taken advantage of our fascination with thieves, crooks, and killers, particularly when they're a pair. Whether taking from real life, Bonnie and Clyde, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or creating wholly original partners, Walter White, Jesse Pinkman, Thelma and Louise, these are dangerous duos that live rent-free in our heads. Here are some of our favorite partners in crime from film and TV. I don't think that they're in any particular sequence or ranking, but our first one, Walter White and Jesse Pinkman from Breaking Bad, 2008 to 2013. We're pretty sure that launching into a meth production and distribution partnership isn't the best way to take your student under your wing, but that's exactly what this former science teacher, played by Bryan Cranston, did with his ex-student, played by Aaron Paul, and sure enough, a little drug dealing did lead to a little murder. Nancy and Andy Botwin from Weeds, 2005 to 2012. Talk about a family business. Nancy, played by Mary Louise Parker, couldn't seem to keep her deceased husband's brother Andy, played by Justin Kirk, out of her Mary Jane distribution biz. Good thing they had such a comfortable rapport. George Young and Diego Delgado from Blow in 2001. This biopic proves the old adage that there's no honor among thieves. When times are good and the money is flowing, everything's great between these two coke dealers, played by Johnny Depp and Jordi Moya. But when things go bad, they go really bad. Thurgood and Brian from Half-Baked in 1998. These stoner pals, played by Dave Chappelle and Jim Breuer, have noble intent when they steal lab-grade marijuana to raise money to get their friend out of jail, And unsurprisingly, these nice guys get into hilarious trouble with both the cops and a rival dealer. Stringer Bell and Avon Barksdale from The Wire in 2002 to 2008. There is no such thing as good guys and bad guys on The Wire, or at least not as demarcated by the thin blue line. But drug lord Avon Barksdale, played by Wood Harris, and his business-minded consigliere, Stringer Bell, played by Idris Elba, were the Baltimore Police Department's public enemies number one and two. Yet, loyalty only goes so far on the streets, and they ended up just as complicit in their own downfall as any detective. Dale Denton and Paul Silver from Pineapple Express in 2008. What happens when a pot smoker and his dealer have to go on the run and become best buds? If it's Seth Rogen as ne'er-do-well process server Dave and James Franco as easygoing low-level dealer Saul, you get one really funny bromance of a movie. Juliette Hulme and Pauline Parker from Heavenly Creatures. Based on true events, Heavenly Creatures follows the close friendship between Juliette Hulme, played by Kate Winslet, and Pauline Parker, played by Melanie Lynskey, teenage girls who go to great lengths to protect their relationship in an oppressive environment that threatens to tear them apart, even if it means plotting murder. Pedro de Pacas and Anthony Stoner from Up in Smoke, 1978. Hey, who are we to judge a little recreational drug use? Or a lot? Or enough to give a blue whale a serious case of the munchies? But the 5-0 are continuously harassing these blurry-eyed jesters played by stoner icons Richard Cheech Marin and Tommy Chong for their copious intake of that wacky tobacco. Jimmy the Gent Conway and Henry Hill from Goodfellas, 1990. Martin Scorsese's 1990 organized crime masterpiece is one of the few films that gets away with having no truly likable characters. That's because the real attraction comes from the life they live, the cars, the coke, the backdoor entry. And by the time Ray Liotta's Henry Hill betrays his half-Irish mentor, Jimmy Conway, played by the part-Irish Robert De Niro, it's clear that no one is a hero. Roxy Hart and Velma Kelly from Chicago, 2002. These two scintillating, quote-unquote, killer dealers may not have committed any crimes together, but by the end of the film, they've both gotten away with murder and become partners in a dazzling musical act. Let's just say the men in their lives had it coming, and all that jazz. Huey and Frank Lucas from American Gangster in 2007. Frank, played by Denzel Washington, can't quite get his brother Huey, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, to learn that the key to keeping your drug empire is keeping a low profile. No flashy clothes or extravagant purchases. As soon as Frank himself ignores that rule, it's downhill from there. Billy and Wyatt from Easy Rider, 1969. Though they were just setting out after a good time at Mardi Gras, Billy, played by Dennis Hopper, and Wyatt, played by Peter Fonda's cross-country journey, along with some LSD, teaches them that there's a lot more to seek out of life. But that realization comes too late for them to do any real good. Manny Ribera and Tony Montana from Scarface, 1983. Manny, played by Stephen Bauer, is the best right-hand man a drug lord like Tony, played by Al Pacino, could want. But shockingly, that still doesn't work out so well for him. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. That's in the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid from 1969. With the combined good looks and charisma of Paul Newman and Robert Redford, these Wild West brigands could have driven a bus full of nuns into an orphanage and we'd still be in their thrall. So what's the big deal about taking some money from E.H. Harrington of the Union Pacific Railroad? The two actors would team up again as another pair of historical and lighthearted criminals a few years later in 1973's The Sting. High and Ed McDonough from Raising Arizona, 1987. Nicolas Cage is High, that's H-I, an ex-convict. Holly Hunter is Ed, a police officer who loves them anyway. The pair marry and hope to have children, but Ed is infertile, and High's record means they cannot adopt. Desperate, the duo learns of quintuplets born to a local wealthy family and kidnaps one of the newborn sons. Hijinks ensue. Lee and Charlie Strom from The Killers in 1964. The film begins from their perspective, but it becomes obvious very quickly that these are no good guys. Played coldly and ruthlessly by Lee Marvin and Clue Gulager, the hitmen in this 1964 adaptation of an Ernest Hemingway short story, it was filmed previously in 1946 with Burt Lancaster, are the direct antecedents of the ones in Pulp Fiction from 1994. They're scary, but you can't take your eyes off them. Brandon Shaw and Philip Morgan from Rope in 1948. What makes the Leopold and Loeb-esque murders, played by John Dahl and Farley Granger in Alfred Hitchcock's self-contained, essentially real-time Rope, so frightening, is that they're in possession of their faculties. They strangle a former classmate to death just to see if they could get away with it, turning a cold-blooded killing into a twisted academic experiment. Saul Natural and Sonny Wardzik from Dog Day Afternoon, 1975. When a simple bank robbery goes awry, these partners in crime decide to make a last stand, taking hostages and making demands. But things just continue to go wrong for both the brains of the operation, played by Al Pacino, and his henchmen, played by John Cazale. Dr. Evil and Mini-Me. Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me in 1999, and Austin Powers in Goldmember 2002. Of course, a narcissist like Dr. Evil, played by Mike Myers, would adore the idea of a mini clone of himself. And even though he barely says anything, Mini-Me's, played by Vern Troyer's, ardent loyalty to Dr. Evil knows no bounds. Perry Smith and Dick Hickok from In Cold Blood, 1967. Based on a true story, and for star Robert Blake, strangely foreboding of another real-life story, this adaptation of Truman Capote's true crime book follows the process of a single terrible act, from its planning to its ultimate punishment, through the eyes of its two perpetrators. Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow from Bonnie and Clyde, 1967. The ultimate lovers on the run, Warren Beatty's Clyde and Faye Dunaway's Bonnie, shoot, rob, and kill their way to a bloody end, changing American film and film criticism in the process. Corky and Violet from Bound, 1996. The Wachowskis' tense erotic thriller centers on Corky, played by Gina Gershon, an ex-convict who hooks up with Violet, played by Jennifer Tilly, a gangster's moll. Longing for freedom, Violet finds an opportunity to embezzle money from the mafia, and the pair navigate the tricky waters of how to get away with it. Holly and Kit from Badlands, 1973. Terrence Malick's story of a murder spree in America's heartland was inspired by the same true story that later spawned Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska. It's a melancholy, dreamlike fairy tale punctuated by violence, and Martin Sheen is perfect as the charismatic but dangerous rebel who charms Sissy Spacek's naive but complicit teenager. Mickey and Mallory Knox from Natural Born Killers, 1994. Mickey, played by Woody Harrelson, and Mallory, played by Juliette Lewis, are what happened after Bonnie and Clyde died and hell spit them back up again for more. And Oliver Stone's film is their story turned up to an 11, a screaming, chaotic assault of frenetic imagery and culture criticism. It's like a two-hour guided tour of a sadistic person's headspace. Clarence Worley and Alabama Whitman from True Romance, 1993. The lighter half of Quentin Tarantino's two murderous couples writing credits, Clarence, played by Christian Slater, and Alabama, played by Patricia Arquette, aren't really that sadistic at all. On the run from some unsavory types they stole a suitcase of cocaine from, all they want to do is spend their days making out and communing with Elvis. Annie Laurie Starr and Bart Tarr from Gun Crazy, 1950. Bart, played by John Dahl, is a young man with an obsession with firearms. Annie, played by Peggy Cummins, is a carnival sharpshooter. They're a match made in heaven, at least until they begin a series of armed robberies in lieu of a honeymoon. Vincent Vega and Jules Winfield are next. They're from Pulp Fiction, 1994. They can casually discuss the romantic implications of foot massages and then bust into an apartment like a black-suited Bible-citing hurricane, shooting its occupants dead. Jules, played by Samuel L. Jackson, may be the one with the wallet that proclaims it, but both of these guys are bad mofos. Unexpected on this list, we have Dick Dastardly and Muttley. From Dastardly and Muttley and Their Flying Machines, this is a cartoon, 1969 to 1970. Man's best friend indeed, Muttley, voiced by Don Messick, put up with his accident-prone, villainous boss through everything, though he may have let loose a little laugh at Dastardly's, that's played by Paul Winchell's, talk of the next great plan. Louise Sawyer and Thelma Dickinson from Thelma and Louise, 1991. The murderous cross-country trip in that blue Thunderbird taken by waitress Louise, played by Susan Sarandon, and sheltered housewife Thelma, played by Gina Davis, is possibly the most well-known female buddy film, famous as much for their journey of self-discovery as for the feminist undertones, and yes, the revelation of Brad Pitt. Lou Langston and Jackie Cleaver from Love Lies Bleeding, 2024 is the last one on our list. Love can make you do wild things, such as the case for gym manager Lou, played by Kristen Stewart, and bodybuilder Jackie, played by Katie O'Brien, who enter a passionate romance in 1989 New Mexico. After Lou's sister is hospitalized because of her abusive husband, Jackie takes matters into her own hands, going down an increasingly dangerous path. That was our list. 30. Some of those are much older movies than I expected. This was our 30 favorite pop culture partners in crime from Walt and Jesse to Thelma and Louise, and it was by Kevin Jacobson. The next season of The Pitt is in production, and Entertainment Weekly is reporting that The Pitt will take on immediate consequences of Trump's Medicaid cuts in season 2. This is going to be a problem. You don't have to take a political position to discuss what the impact is actually going to be, executive producer John Wells adds. This is by Mikeshana Pierre. Season 1 of The Pitt wasn't afraid to show the harsh realities of what goes down in the chaotic world of ER medical professionals, and its upcoming installment plans to do the same. Star and producer Noah Wiley and executive producers John Wells and R. Scott Gemmel outlined how season two of the HBO Max medical drama will incorporate President Donald Trump's controversial policy changes introduced in the so-called Big Beautiful Bill in a new interview with Variety. You don't have to take a political position to discuss what the impact of the Medicaid changes is actually going to be, Wells says. They're going to have on-the-ground immediate consequences in emergency rooms, and nobody's arguing with that. That's a bipartisan agreement. You've got very Republican senators from Missouri like Josh Hawley agreeing that this is going to be a problem. Trump signed the bill in question into law on July 4th. The legislation extends the president's 2017 tax cuts and increases defense and border wall funds, while also including $930 billion in cuts to Medicaid and other cuts to food assistance, clean energy programs, and student loans. We have a certain safety net in just being a realistic drama by trying to depict what it looks like in a hospital, Wiley told the outlet of the show's tendency to show multiple sides of an argument. You're not making value judgments, you're just painting a picture, and if it's accurate enough and it's representative enough, it becomes a bit of a Rorschach test. You see what you want to see in it, and you draw your own conclusions from it. If it looks like the system is untenable, unfair, and skewed towards one population over another, maybe it is. Viewers can expect the series to address real-life concerns about patient care, including the treatment of patients of color and undocumented and immigrant families amid the recent ICE raids, as the show grapples with issues that stem from policies that went into effect this year. We take our platform very seriously, Gemmel says. I think one of the things when you can reach 10 million people, and this was true back in the day on ER as well, is with that amount of people listening, you have to be responsible for what you put out there. Wells added, we have a lot of people to call on to ask what's likely to happen. As Gemmel pointed out, when people have less finances from the government to help them with their health care, they're going to get less health care. And that means they're going to end up in the only place where they can get free health care, which is the ER. So the ER is just going to get busier and become more of a safety net. And it's already broken, so the system is destined for a tipping point. But it isn't just new policy changes that the Pitt is looking to tackle. Wiley shared that several storylines on the show will also address age-old issues that have plagued the medical industry since its inception, namely the systematic and sometimes unconscious bias in healthcare that affect the quality of healthcare received by marginalized communities. Wells told Variety that he's hopeful that medical professionals will both see themselves in the Pitt but privately question and rectify their own unconscious bias about patients from marginalized groups. The Pitt was renewed for a second season in February, with Warner Brothers Television declaring it as the streamer's most watched title globally. Season 2 is expected to arrive in January 2026. Max CEO Casey Bloys told Vulture earlier this year. Wells previously confirmed to Entertainment Weekly that, like season one, next season will unfold across another 15-hour workday. It's going to be a single shift, he says. The intent here is to let us follow and understand and feel what happens to emergency room physicians and all the other medical personnel during those kinds of shifts. We'll get senses of what their lives are outside, and we'll get information based on what's happened in their lives outside, but within the workplace. He continued, it's a workplace family, and that's where we're going to learn about our characters. They come to work and they clock in and they stay until they're done. So this isn't a show that's going to end up following a lot of people home and seeing them for Thanksgiving dinner. The Pitt season 2 began filming in June. Season 1 is currently streaming on HBO Max. That was The Pitt will take on immediate consequences of Trump's Medicaid cuts in season 2. This is going to be a problem. And it was by Mekashana Pierre. And I think I have just one more moment for this quick one. Netflix revives William Shatner's classic cop drama, T.J. Hooker, as a movie. This is by Kristen Baldwin. Attention, criminal scum! Your days are numbered because Los Angeles County's toughest uniformed officer is about to walk the beat again. Entertainment Weekly has confirmed that Netflix is developing an action comedy film based on T.J. Hooker, the classic TV crime drama starring William Shatner as the titular cop. Deadline first reported the news. The movie adaptation is being written by Jared Paul and Andy Mogul. Hooker premiered on ABC in 1982, where it ran for 3 seasons before moving to CBS for 1 more season. Shatner starred as former plainclothes detective T.J. Hooker, who decides to return to uniformed police work after his partner is killed in the line of duty. Working alongside newer officers Stacy Sheridan, played by Heather Locklear, Vince Romano, played by Adrian Zmed, and Jim Corrigan, played by James Darren, Hooker dedicates himself to ridding the streets of Los Angeles of dangerous criminals, one caller at a time. When reached for comment by Entertainment Weekly, Shatner's representative shared this response from the actor via email. "I know nothing. It would be a lovely idea to resurrect the legendary character, but I have no idea what's going on." Throughout its 4-year run, T.J. Hooker mixed cop show drama, drug pushers, teen prostitutes, serial killers, with flashy stunt casting. Guest stars included Carl Wilson of the Beach Boys, legendary piano man Jerry Lee Lewis, and even Shatner's longtime Star Trek co-star Leonard Nimoy. Writers Paul and Mogul, who created Rob Lowe's woefully short-lived Fox comedy The Grinder, should have no trouble transforming T.J. Hooker into an action comedy because the show itself was often hilarious, even if unintentionally. For example, there's a link to a video on YouTube in this article that's titled "Stupid Shit in T.J. Hooker Excessive Baton Twirl Fight." Thanks to its melodramatic storylines and Shatner's over-the-top performance, T.J. Hooker became a pop culture punchline, though Shatner maintained a sense of humor about the show. In 1986, the year Hooker went off the air, the actor reprised the character in a sketch while hosting Saturday Night Live. A note to Netflix execs, Shatner is not opposed to revisiting his most famous roles. Last year, he told a Canadian outlet that he'd be open to returning to Star Trek if the part was well written. That was Netflix revives William Shatner's classic cop drama, T.J. Hooker, as a movie, and it was by Kristen Baldwin. Boy, we are out of time for Entertainment Weekly this week. I snuck that one in at the end, but I used up all of our time. Thank you for listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona and Entertainment Weekly. I've been reading from their website, EW.com. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury. Until next time, goodbye.